Hello and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs, the Daily Nonpareil. We're reading the Sunday's edition of December 20th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. The front page features a large story that is titled Iowa Endures. And it says 24 hours, 9 newsrooms, 3 million Iowans, 1 virus, hardship and hope in a single day of the pandemic. And it seems to be a tour through Iowa and the area with pictures accompanying each of the text that is describing that. So I will read the front page, and it will probably set up the series, and we'll read some of that along the way as we touch various parts of the paper. Nurse Connor Ramirez balances a cell phone between her ear and shoulder blade as she maneuvers a patient's bulky bed through Mary Greeley Medical Center's back hallways. 4 colleagues run alongside, toting medical equipment and the patient's belongings as the sun finally begins to peek out from a cloudy morning fog. Elevator G29, Ramirez says over the commotion, dispatching a cleaning crew to disinfect the lift just as soon as they hang up. We're transferring a COVID patient to the ICU. In Des Moines, a music teacher starts his digital lesson, his piano guitar recorder, and slide whistle at all within reach. In the Quad Cities, a bus driver tells his riders to wear masks to keep each other safe. All across the Hawkeye State, exercise classes, sanitize masks, stages sit barren, restaurants open with tables spread apart, and computers hum in home offices, corporate buildings closed by the pandemic. In Waterloo, Nurse Kelly Barnett dons a gown, an N95 mask, a face shield, gloves, and goggles to work on the COVID-19 floor at Unity Point's Allen Hospital. Barnett prayed as she drove in this morning, as she does every day. She pleaded with God to help her patients recover and begged for Iowa to turn the corner on the virus still sweeping our state. It feels like we're kind of in a war zone, Barnett says. There's a lot of sick people who are coming in and out every day, and when they are here, you see them get sicker. Iowans are waking up to another day, changed by COVID-19. And on this particular day, Tuesday, December 8th, dozens of reporters and photographers from 9 newsrooms across 2 media companies fanned out to chronicle how the coronavirus has altered life in Iowa. But amid the many difficulties and disruptions, this day ushers in flashes of joy, too, moments of where Iowans offer a helping hand or when they band together. Over nearly 24 hours, one truth emerges. Even in the toughest of circumstances, Iowa endures. And so the story continues with a photo essay and descriptions of each of these different places. The first one is at 3:45 a.m. Hudson, and there's a picture of a milking station with many, many tubes, and looks like a row of cows facing the center of the room. Moose, thrumming machinery, and upbeat country crooners punctuate the pre-dawn darkness as dozens of Hanson's dairy workers move in between the stalls, cleaning and milking cows, besides everyone's matching cow print face masks. Not much has changed on this farm, says co-owner Blake Hanson. As a farmer, dairy farmer especially, life doesn't stop, he says. Cows still need to be milked. But escaping into routine has been a welcome distraction for many of Hanson's workers, some of whom have had family members come down with COVID-19. Everything's almost normal here, says Zach Miller, a 22-year-old University of Northern Iowa student. I just come to work and enjoy what I do. 7:29 a.m. The sun rises across most of Iowa. 7:53 a.m., Des Moines. Cars queue up outside Polk County's Test, Iowa site as cases of COVID-19 spike around the country. This facility's line has been known to stretch out of the pothole-filled gravel lot and onto the road. And, of course, there is a picture of cars lined up seeking to get their test Iowa. 6:34 a.m. Des Moines. Christmas ornaments and stockings emblazoned with glitter glue pepper the walls of Smoky Row, a cozy coffee shop on the edge of I-235, as the nutty smell of fresh-brewed coffee kicks off the day. Morgan Strang and her roommate Grace Ketter Henry find a booth in the large, airy cafe, where about half the tables are blocked off to ensure social distancing. The pair are up bright and early to study for finals. Drake University student Clara Fauchner is studying too, setting up her laptop at a corner table by the window. The health sciences junior says she comes in most mornings and stays for a few hours, leaving when the shop begins to get crowded. It used to be comforting that there were people here, like filling up and talking and stuff, Fauchner said. Now it's kind of a source of anxiety. And, of course, there's a picture of the Smoky Row coffee shop. And as it indicated, only two people are sitting at a lone table. At 8 a.m., Sioux City. Dividers around slot machines keep Bill Goodman distanced from other players as the Army veteran tries his luck at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino, Sioux City. Can we double-check whether veteran means military veteran rather than veteran gambler or some such? If so, let's say military veteran, or better yet, say which branch. And there's a picture, of course, of Mr. Bill Goodman sitting at a large display of a video slot machine. We have we're backtracking to 7:20 a.m. Sioux City. There's a big a sign on the wall that says, "Thank you, Sioux City Police Department," with several hearts and handprints dotting the sign. And there's a picture of a police officer signing up at a table with displays of hand sanitizer and other items. 7:20 a.m. Sioux City. It's still dark when police officer Jeffrey Dimitri enters headquarters through a back door and beelines to a table of cleaning supplies. Rubbing in a squirt of sanitizer before he slips his right hand into a plastic bag and grabs a thermometer, Dimitri must register below 100.4 degrees to clock in. Any temperature above that threshold could be a symptom of COVID-19. 98.6, Dimitri says. Looks like I'm working today. Wearing a pair of black gloves and wielding disinfectant, Dimitri goes to his idling vehicle, where he sanitizes the steering wheel, door handles, and keyboard on his in-vehicle laptop computer. Instead of gathering in the briefing room where officers used to catch up on families and football, he'll soon slide into the driver's seat and log on for a virtual roll call before hitting the streets. 8:19 a.m., West Burlington. Kyra Gar, 15, plays Lungungtu's tunes on her bass clarinet while warming up for a socially distant rehearsal with about 30 of her West Burlington High School bandmates. Practices take place in the auditorium, a cavernous space designed for 300 people, spread out among the rows like morsels in a chocolate chip cookie. Each student musician has his or her own music and music stand as the band preps for its upcoming Christmas concert. The hardest thing about the concert is you never know from one week to the next if a kid is going to go on quarantine or if they're going to go virtual or if they are not going to be there anymore, says Mark Everleth, the school's band director. And, of course, there is a picture taken from the front and looking to the back of the cavernous auditorium as it was described, and there is Kyra Gar playing her bass clarinet. 8:21 a.m., rural Scott County. Rob Ewald walks the concrete aisle dividing the hog confinement as his trained eyes flit over the roughly 1,250 white barrows, castrated male hogs squealing in pens on either side. Besides raising hogs, Ewald drives a truck to pick up some extra money. Last week's COVID outbreaks among meatpacking workers uprooted his schedule. When a packing plant closed, Ewald's routes for hauling hogs would often change on short notice. "You never know where you were going," he says. "You never knew where you were going," he says. Of course, there's a picture of Mr. Rob Ewald checking his logbook, which is in a binder, and looking down the long row of confinement pens. 9:08 a.m., Des Moines. Hazmat suit, heavy-duty boots, rubber gloves, gas mask. For Tim Allen, head of the Des Moines Fire Department's daily decontamination team, donning the gear needed to sanitize ambulances just back from COVID-related emergency calls has become second nature. About six or seven times a day, vehicles from across the metro rumble into Station 1 for a deep clean, Allen says. And it's not just his look that's been upgraded. Instead of hoses and bleach, firefighters brandish a sanitizing gun that uses static electricity to bind cleaning solution onto surfaces. "I don't know if this is going to be a forever thing, but it'll probably go on for another 6 months to a year yet," Allen says. And the picture shows, of course, Tim Allen putting on some orange-looking heavy boots, as he also is wearing what looks like a hazmat suit himself. 9:27 a.m., Moline, Illinois. After every hour-long route, Jose Mancera wipes down the driver's seat area of his bus while a contracted custodian sprays and rubs nearly everywhere else. With a wife and two kids, Mancera takes every precaution, including showering as soon as he gets home and quickly throwing his clothes into the laundry. "We offer masks and hand sanitizers to each passenger," Mancera says. "Sometimes riders complain about the masks. They come up with every excuse in the books. But I always tell them we have to keep each other safe." The article is accompanied by a picture of Mr. Mancera wiping down the partition between him and the incoming passenger area. 9:32 a.m., Rock Island, Illinois. David Van Huysen's funeral home will serve 18 families among its four locations today. "Not a record," he says, "but close." The funeral business has been a roller coaster since the pandemic started its slug across Iowa. The number of mourners at visitations has bounced around from 25 to 50 to 10, according to state rules and the virus positivity rate, he says. From setting up tents and heaters in his parking lot for outdoor ceremonies, to hosting drive-through visitations, to live streaming services across the world, an offering for which he had to acquire a Federal Communications Commission license, finding consistency in the chaos has been important for mourning families, Van Huysen adds. "Everybody's just striving to try to find a way to get through a loss," says his colleague, Joe Perez. The article is accompanied by a picture of several funeral home directors standing in the midst of a large visit room, chairs appropriately spaced 6 feet apart. 9:35 a.m., Monty Morris, former Iowa State University basketball player, agrees to a three-year, $27 million extension with the Denver Nuggets. 9:35 a.m., Des Moines. The heavy December fog grounds Life Flight helicopters on the 8th-floor helipad at Iowa Methodist Medical Center. Life Flight has been transporting at least one patient with COVID-19 per day, flight nurse Brian Dotz says. 9:40 a.m., Pottawatomie County. Deputy Richard Hyatt sips from his large Nebraska Cornhuskers tumbler as he recounts contracting COVID-19 in September and recovering from its, thankfully, mild symptoms. A jovial, talkative guy who's been with the sheriff's office almost 7 years, Hyatt says it can be hard to communicate effectively with people while wearing masks. You have to talk a little bit louder and a little bit slower, and they do as well. He says, I hate to have someone have to repeat themselves, especially a victim. He says, the more they repeat it, the more worked up they get about what happened. And the article is accompanied by a picture of Deputy Hyatt standing aside his patrol car and wearing a mask. 9:46 a.m. Ames. After transporting Sephiram to his intensive care unit and removing the plexiglass box covering her upper body, Mary Greeley's way of ensuring COVID-19 infected droplets don't spread as positive patients are moved through the hospital, nurse Julie Siebold gently pulls a blanket over Sephiram's legs and feet. Are you in any pain, sweetie? She asks, shouting just a bit over her mask, face shield, and the BiPAP machine pumping oxygen in Sephiram's lungs. Can you squeeze my hand? She urges as Sephiram complies with a light grip. Good, good, Siebold says. Sephiram tested positive for coronavirus just before Thanksgiving, but the virus didn't affect her until almost 2 weeks later, when her daughter brought her to the ER with breathing difficulties. Despite a weekend on heated, high-flow oxygen therapy, Sephiram's oxygen saturation levels still aren't improving, Dr. Tamin Mahaini explains. If the team can't get those levels up, the next step is to put Sephiram on a ventilator, he says. This is the progression of serious COVID, he says. It's like they are slowly drowning. As Mahaini suits up to examine Sephiram, a respiratory therapist adjusts the straps on Sephiram's oxygen mask, and Siebold rubs her hand, watching the numbers on her monitor. It's okay. You're with us now, Siebold says quietly, pausing between each phrase. It's okay. We're going to help. The article is accompanied by pictures of those mentioned in the article attending to the patient. 10 o'clock a.m., Des Moines. Although her students are at home, art teacher Kathleen Warren still goes into her classroom at Windsor Elementary School to host lessons. On this sketchbook day for her fourth graders, Warren pulls nouns and verbs from small stacks of note cards to form their drawing prompt. Calm, tall, robot, in a band. Her students have 5 minutes to complete their drawing before showing their final creation. He's playing some drums, says one student, mimicking the booms and bams of a set as he draws. 10 a.m., Des Moines. The state updates its dashboard to reflect that 2,919 people have died from coronavirus since the disease first appeared in Iowa. 10:05 a.m., Story City. Now would normally be the Story City locker's slow season, when workers would buoy the budget by processing deer for hunters, co-owner Austin Overholzer says. But with shortages of meat on grocery stores' shelves in early months of the pandemic, and with more people wanting to bypass the conventional meat industry, the locker is booked through the end of next year with orders for custom butchering of cows, pigs, and lambs. While his workers have experienced few changes due to COVID-19, the virus is never far from Overholzer's mind. He and his 8 co-workers have such specialized jobs in the process of breaking down an animal that if any one of them got pulled from the production line, they probably have to close for 2 weeks. And, of course, the article is accompanied by a picture of one of the butchers with a large, looks like a hacksaw, dealing with a large hunk of beef. The worker is wearing a black outfit with a hood and a mask. 10:07 a.m., South Sioux City. Lee Olson squares off against Karen Hoag for a friendly game of pickleball twice a week at the Norm Watt Senior YMCA. When they're not slicing and chopping balls across the net, the pair will walk the track. The Y requires everyone to wear a mask except when working out and separated by more than 6 feet. During peak times, a Y employee walks the facility to enforce the rules, says membership director Kelly Horton, pictured above. We all want to stay healthy, Horton says. The article is accompanied by a picture of Kelly, let's see, if Kelly Horton, and she's standing aside a sign that says, "Is your face mask on?" We'll take a break from our tour of Iowa during the pandemic to look at the opinion page. And our opinion is, the first is from Joe Nocera, Bloomberg Opinion. Bankruptcy is the solution to the student loan crisis. To understand why we have a student loan crisis, and with $1.6 trillion in outstanding student debt, it surely is a crisis. Just look at the U.S. bankruptcy code. In 1965, Congress passed the Higher Education Act, part of President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. On the one hand, the new law established federal grants and loan programs to ease the monetary burden of attending college, especially for disadvantaged students. On the other hand, the bill included rules that made it difficult to discharge a federal student loan in bankruptcy. Over the next four decades, Congress added additional restrictions that made it not just difficult but impossible to shed a federal student loan, no matter how dire a borrower's circumstances. In 2005, Congress crossed the final frontier. It added privately issued student debt to its no-discharge list. We've all heard the horror stories that ensued. Students enrolled in for-profit colleges only to discover their diplomas didn't get them the job they had been led to expect, leaving them only with an impossible debt overhang. Former students defaulted, only to have their wages garnished by the federal government, which was as ruthless as any collection agency. Loan servicers found reasons to pile on additional fees and charges. Nearly one out of five former students is in default, according to the Pew Research Center. The student loan burden has been debilitating for millions of people who hoped that taking on that debt would lead to a better life, only to discover that, for one reason or another, it didn't. But there is another, larger, unacknowledged consequence of outlawing the discharge of student loans in a bankruptcy. It ushered in a lot of moral hazard. Remember the subprime housing bubble, when brokers sold homes to anyone with a pulse, knowing their firms would offload the loans to Wall Street, so they didn't care whether the borrowers would ever repay the money? The student loan industry is built on a similar premise. The federal government gives student loans to just about anyone who asks, regardless of income or ability to repay, knowing the borrower can't ever elude the debt. The same is true of private lenders. Universities raise the cost of tuition with impunity year after year, knowing that loans will always absorb the increases. For-profit colleges wouldn't exist if students could discharge their loans in bankruptcy. Their entire business model is predicated on being paid up front by the federal government, which then becomes the entity that has to worry about being repaid. With student loans, a risk-free venture for lenders and universities, is it any wonder that student debt has become the second largest form of consumer debt in the U.S., trailing only mortgages? As a general proposition, I'm sympathetic to those who are calling on President-elect Joe Biden to erase some of that debt once he takes office. According to Senator Elizabeth Warren, 42 million Americans have student loans. She has filed a bill to cancel $50,000 of that debt for each of them. That legislation has gained favor among progressives who are pressing Biden to take action through executive order as soon as he is sworn in. Biden has floated a more modest $10,000 relief plan through legislation. The rationale isn't just to help former students unable to pay back their loans, but to help the economy. Student debt is preventing many millennials from buying their first home. Between 2005 and 2015, home ownership among people ages 25 to 34 dropped by 10 percentage points. It is making it impossible for former students to start small businesses or take jobs that don't pay a lot of money. It makes it harder to get credit to buy other things. In other words, it holds back millions of young Americans from participating fully in economic life, which has a ripple effect across the entire economy. Canceling student debt would act as much-needed economic stimulus. But I also understand the resistance to loan forgiveness, especially among conservatives. It wouldn't be fair to millions of Americans who did pay off their student loans, often after years of financial struggle, they argue. It would help high-income professionals with graduate degrees more than low-income former students, as my Bloomberg Opinion colleague Michael R. Strain pointed out recently. And as much as relief might bolster the economy, it would be enormously divisive when the incoming president is trying to unite Democrats and Republicans. Which brings me back to bankruptcy. Passing a law that allows student loans to be included in a bankruptcy filing is the obvious compromise. It doesn't give either side anything it wants, but it gives each of them enough to make it an acceptable solution. For those advocating canceling student debt, changing the bankruptcy law would do just that. Former students wouldn't be able to discharge only $10,000 or $50,000, but their entire debt load. Because the federal government owns more than 90% of student loans, it would absorb the vast majority of the debt. The government might also need to cover the losses for the debt that isn't federally guaranteed, because private institutions made the loans before the change in the law. For those opposed to canceling the debt, there would be some comfort in knowing that bankruptcy comes at a price. It would be a part of a borrower's credit report for 7 or 10 years, depending on whether Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 is used. The availability of credit would be sharply diminished during those periods, eliminating the ability to obtain a mortgage and other loans. The best part is that when incoming students wanted loans, the bank or the government would have to do some true underwriting. In many cases, parents would have to co-sign, which would limit the size of the loan to their ability to repay. Universities would have to think twice before raising tuition because loans wouldn't necessarily cover the increase anymore. The business model of for-profit colleges might well be irreparably harmed, which would be a good thing given that too many of them seemed like scams. The key point is that 18-year-olds with big dreams would no longer be the ones deciding whether they could repay $100,000 or more in student loans. The lender would have to be responsible as well. To those who would argue that this plan would make it nearly impossible for working class and poor students to obtain student loans, the answer is, you're right, but there is a solution to that problem as well. The government has long had repayment plans based on income. The idea is that after graduating, the former student pays a percentage of income, usually 10%, for a fixed period of time, usually 10 years. The problem with these plans is that they are absurdly difficult to get into and just as difficult to stay in because they require reapplying every year. Making it simple to enroll in these programs should be a Biden administration priority. After that, a Biden student loan program could give students a choice. They could either agree to pay back the loans or agree to turn over a portion of their post-graduation income over 10 or to 15 years or the government in lieu of full repayment. For certain kinds of public service jobs, the percentage of income could be reduced. There are many other possible variations that would make income-based repayment plans desirable. In the worst-case scenarios for borrowers who couldn't repay, bankruptcy would still be an option. The original impulse of the 1965 Higher Education Act was noble, to make it possible for millions of Americans who couldn't afford college to nonetheless get a college degree. 50 years later, making it impossible for students to get that degree without a crushing burden of debt is just as noble. Bankruptcy is one way to help get there. That was authored by Joe Nocera, a Bloomberg opinion columnist covering business. He's written business columns for Esquire, GQ, and the New York Times, and is the former editorial director of Fortune. His latest project is the Bloomberg Wondery podcast, The Shrink Next Door. You are listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs, the Daily Nonpareil, for the we're reading the Sunday, December 20 edition on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we turn to the obituaries listed in the Sunday paper. David Roy Cumberledge of Carter Lake, Iowa, passed at the age of 77 on Thursday, December 17th. Visitation will be held at Coy Kilnoski Funeral Home on 16th Street in Council Bluffs on Tuesday, December 22nd, from 5 to 7 p.m. The funeral service will be at the Carter Lake Presbyterian Church on 9th Street in Carter Lake on Wednesday, December 23rd at 10 a.m. The burial service will follow at Garner Township Cemetery, Council Bluffs, for David Roy Cumberledge, who died at the age of 77 on Thursday, December 17th, and as mentioned, Coy Kilnoski Funeral Home, Council Bluffs, is handling arrangements. Gloria Edith McClure, 86, of Council Bluffs, passed away on December 16 at Midlands Living Center. Open visitation Tuesday, 12 noon to 5 p.m. Private family services will be held. Interment in the Silver City Cemetery, memorials to Every Step Hospice Preferred. The Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home is handling arrangements for Gloria Edith McClure. Evelyn J. Hancock, age 93, of Council Bluffs, passed away December 15th at Bethany Lutheran Home. Visitation with the family Monday, 5 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Tuesday, 1 p.m. at the funeral home, with funeral being live-streamed on the funeral home website, Interment Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Memorials contributions may be made to a charity of the donor's choice. The Hancock family is thankful to Bethany Lutheran Home and staff for the wonderful care given to their mother and grandmother, Evelyn J. Hancock, and, as mentioned, the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel is handling arrangements. Lois LaVon Dorn Hansen, Council Bluffs, died on December 15th. A private graveside service will be held with family. Celebration of life will be planned for a future date. Memorials may be sent to Our Savior's Lutheran Church. Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel is handling arrangements for Lois LaVon Dorn Hansen. Shirley R. Golden, 91, of Council Bluffs, passed away on Thursday at her residence with her loving family at her side. Visitation with family on Sunday from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Funeral service on Tuesday, 11 a.m. at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. Burial at Grange Cemetery, rural Honey Creek. Memorials, St. Paul's Lutheran Church, which is located on Frank Street. Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel Funeral Home handling arrangements for Shirley R. Golden, who died doesn't say the date of the death, but she was age 91. Donna Jean Henke Liggett Gillett, age 86, passed away December 16. Donna's visitation for Donna will be Sunday, December 27, 2 to 4 p.m. at Hoy Kanowski Funeral Home. Celebration of life will be held at a later date. The family will direct memorials for Donna Jean Henke Liggett-Gillette. Irvin Henry Moss, 93, passed away Thursday, December 17th, at his home, surrounded by his family. Visitation Monday, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., followed by funeral services at 11 a.m., all at Cutler, O'Neill, Meyer, Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. Interment, Lewis Township Cemetery, with military rites by the VFW and American Legion Post 2, memorials to Emmanuel Lutheran Church, Cutler, O'Neill, Meyer, Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral services, handling arrangements for Irvin Henry Moss, who died at the age of 93 on December 17th. Luetta Cardell Peterson, age 90, passed away on December 16th, and interment will be in the Garner Cemetery. Celebration of life will be at a later date. The Coy Kilnowski Funeral Home and Cremation Service is handling arrangements for Luetta Cardell Peterson, age 90, who died on December 16th. And now we turn to the sports page for some prep news. High school basketball, AHSTW wins close one over St. Albert. And the editor's note is that due to the early press deadline Saturday night, some local content may not appear in this Sunday edition. You can check the website nonpareilonline.com or Tuesday's edition for more. And this is Dateline Avoca. Cole Scheffler's three at the buzzer gave AHSTW a wild 63-60 victory over St. Albert on Saturday. Just moments before Scheffler's heroics, St. Albert's Cy Patterson knocked down a pair of pressure free throws with 34 seconds remaining, tying it 60-60. On AHSTW's ensuing possession, the Vikings ran the clock down, then tried to make something happen. Stingy defense from the Falcons forced Scheffler into a forced three, but it fell through and kept a zero in the loss column for AHSTW, which now has a season record of 8-0. St. Albert, now 1-4, senior Sam Rollis scored a game-high 24 points. Cy Patterson finished with 10. Scheffler, a 5'8" sophomore, finished with 14 points for the Vikings, while Raiden Groby and Braden Lund each had 17. In girls basketball, Sydney 61, St. Albert 54. Lauren Williams scored a game-high 24 points, but Sydney came away with a 61-54 victory on Saturday. Shea Ward and Alexis Massey led the way offensively for Sydney with 16 points apiece. St. Albert now 1-6. Sydney has a record of 5-1. Glenwood 73, Harlan 46. Emma Hughes made 7 of Glenwood's 14 three-pointers, leading Class 4A number 1 Glenwood past number 13 Harlan 73-46. Glenwood now stands at 6-0. Harlan has a record of 4-2. And back to boys basketball, Harlan 53, Glenwood 42. Brad Curran scored 13 of his 15 points in the second half, and Harlan went on to an 8-0 run to start fourth quarter to make it 37-27. Glenwood got no closer than 5 after that. Glenwood now stands at 4-1, and Harlan has a 3-2 record. Let's return to the opinion page for the three letters that are published. It is The first is from Angie Dobbins of Council Bluffs. Thank you to Hanusa Dawson on 911 bill. On behalf of Iowa APCO and Iowa NENA, we want to thank the 88th General Assembly of the Iowa Legislature for passing Senate File 2373. This bill made an important change to Iowa law by defining telecommunicators 911 dispatchers as public safety telecommunicators and recognizing their role as first responders. We want to specifically thank Senator Dan Dawson and Representative Mary Ann Hanusa for leading the charge on this important issue. They understand emergency telecommunicators are an intricate part of the emergency response system and are typically the first public safety point of contact. Collectively, these professionals handle over 1.1 million calls a year in Iowa. Not only did Dawson and Hanusa introduce the bills in their respective chambers, they remained committed to Iowa's public safety professionals until the bill passed. They worked tirelessly after the COVID pause during the session to ensure unanimous passage in both chambers. Thanks to their hard work, Iowa now joins Texas and California in recognizing public safety communicators. They did this because they know 911 professionals are extensively trained and their responsiveness can be the difference in a life or death situation. The Iowa chapters of the Association of Public Safety Communications Officials, APCO, and National Emergency Number Association, NENA, are individual organizations that work together for the betterment of 911, public safety, and telecommunicators across the state. That was the letter submitted by Angie Dobbins of Council Bluffs. Our second letter comes to us from Weaver Johnson of Council Bluffs, Childhood Hunger Magnified by COVID-19. The COVID-19 pandemic has caused childhood hunger to soar to record high levels, with one of in five children in Iowa facing hunger this year. This is more than a health crisis. It's an economic one, too. As a business owner, it's devastating to see the impact on my industry. More than 1,000 restaurants in Iowa are now closed. As a chef, I'm committed to feeding my community, and that extends beyond the four walls of my restaurant. While I'd like to see Congress invest in helping my industry by passing the Restaurants Act, our nation's hunger crisis is a problem we can fix, too. If Congress temporarily increases SNAP benefits by 15%, those in need would have an additional $25 each month. This benefit is a lifeline for anyone in our state facing extreme hardship right now: unemployment, rising food prices, eviction, and hunger. It's critical that Congress gets to work on legislation that includes this SNAP increase. SNAP is one of the most effective ways to feed people and stimulate our economy. Right now, Congress is failing hundreds of thousands of kids by delaying relief legislation and leaving nutrition assistance out of it. I urge Senators Grassley and Ernst to work with Congress to boost SNAP now. That was submitted by Kevin Sharp of Dubuque. That's correct. That's a correction. Kevin Sharp is the author of that previous letter, and I had jumped ahead to the next author. Weaver Johnson of Council Bluffs is the author of this particular letter. How about a meatless Christmas? The long-anticipated Christmas holiday is nearly upon us. It conjures visions of happy families gathered by a warm fireplace, opening presents, sharing their love, and feasting on ham and turkey. It's the happiest time of the year, but not for the animals. The 222 million turkeys killed in the U.S. this year were raised in crowded sheds filled with toxic fumes. At the tender age of 16 weeks, workers cut their throats and dumped them into boiling water to remove their feathers. Mother pigs are crammed for life in tight metal crates. Their babies are torn away, mutilated without anesthesia, stuck into crowded pens for 6 months, then slaughtered for Christmas ham. Consumers pay a heavy price, too. Animal flesh is laced with saturated fats, cholesterol, hormones, pathogens, and antibiotics that elevate risk of chronic killer diseases. This holiday season, let's refuse to subsidize such wanton cruelty. Let's choose from the large variety of plant-based meats, cheeses, ice creams, and milks that abound in every supermarket, along with nutritious fresh fruits and greens. This year, let's have a truly compassionate Christmas holiday, just as the Prince of Peace would counsel. That was the letter by Weaver Johnson of Council Bluffs, and our final letter, Amy Severs, Council Bluffs. Thoughts on virus election. Here are my thoughts, short and to the point. First and foremost, the country is so scared and tired of the virus and the deaths. Second, Joe Biden has won the election. Let's move on. We don't need the added burden of Trump's losing lawsuits and also his vile spewing of lies. The people he was elected to serve and protect, which he took an oath on, are suffering and dying. It's all we can do to deal with the pandemic, much less the harm the president is doing to the country. That was the letter by Amy Severs of Council Bluffs. And those are the letters submitted for publication in the Daily Nonpareil Sunday edition. Then we'll close out our reading with the continuation of the feature story, the 24 hours in Iowa across the as they deal with the coronavirus. 10 a.m. Des Moines. After recess and a snack, Logan Barleen, a second grader at Windsor Elementary, leans into his computer during a virtual lesson to learn about fossils. The room he normally sits in is down the hall, but he moved to a different space to give himself more distance from peers. Outside his room, water fountains are closed. Arrows on the floor direct walking traffic. The faint voices of kids, their comments and stories and answers, ring through teachers' computer speakers and drift into the hallways. The picture is of Logan leaning over the table and peering very intently into the laptop computer on his table. 11:38 a.m. Des Moines. As the morning's heavy fog lifts, a Unity Point Life Flight helicopter receives clearance to fly. In the hours that they were grounded, Nurse Brian Dobbs loaded a cooler of human blood into the bay, and pilot Kyle Johnson cleaned and prepped the helicopter, taking advantage of a brief respite from the increase in flights caused by transporting COVID-19 patients. 11:24 a.m., Davenport, the Quad Cities River Bandits baseball franchise announces it's been invited to become an affiliate of the Kansas City Royals. 12:07 p.m., Mobile. Faith Lambert and Darren Fredrickson stand ready to pounce, waiting for Woodbury Central students to finish their meals before they swoop in. When all that's left are crusts and empty juice boxes, Lambert, head of the district's maintenance department, and Fredrickson, a custodian, work as a tag team to clean each of the 45 lunch tables. Using a backpack outfitted with spray nozzles, Fredrickson applies a concentrated disinfecting solution on the first pass. Lambert finishes up with water on the second. Over a 90-minute lunch period, they clean the school's commons area traditionally reserved for lunch, plus a second spot in the so-called little gym added so students can stay at least 6 feet apart. "We disinfect every time a student leaves the table," says Lambert, beaming with pride over the school's health precautions. "We've had amazing luck with it." And the article is accompanied by a picture of the custodians with their cleaning supplies, wearing masks and shields as they do so. 1 p.m., Mason City. Coach Todd Sandin stands at center ice, cracking jokes in his deep Minnesota accent. Players on his North Iowa Bulls junior hockey team gather around him, laughing as they take a knee before practice. Even as the team prepares for upcoming games, Sandin fears they'll be canceled. The Bulls' biggest rivals weren't allowed to travel recently due to Minnesota's COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the season's pauses, Sandin says the team's cohesion hasn't waned. If anything, it has grown because of the pandemic. I think this year we've spent more time with our group than we ever have in the past, he says. The article is accompanied by Sandin addressing his players as they gather around him in their hockey equipment. At 1:02 p.m., Waterloo. In the shadow of a small Christmas tree perched on her windowsill, Blackhawk County contact tracer Susan Wertjes, 73, listens to a woman talk about her father's death from COVID-19. Offering comfort isn't a formal part of the job, but the small kindness comes naturally for Wertjes, who lost her own father in recent months. Though he was not a victim of the pandemic, Wertjes couldn't be with him as he passed and wasn't able to attend his funeral. Working in teams, Wertjes and her colleagues gather confidential information about people's whereabouts since contracting the virus in hopes of stopping a major outbreak. Reaching grumpy people or leaving voicemails is the norm, she says, but sometimes Wertjes watches her colleagues nodding and engaging in longer conversations, providing desperately needed companionship. You can tell that the isolation of COVID-19 has gotten to all of us, but especially to the elders who are living alone, Wertjes says. They want to stay on the phone forever. The article is accompanied by a picture of contact tracers sitting at large tables spaced apart, and each table has a plexiglass shield placed in front of it. 1:35 p.m., Des Moines. The Polk County officials warned that the number of positive cases of COVID-19 could tick up soon, the consequences of Thanksgiving gatherings possibly starting to show. 2 p.m., Clear Lake. The historic surf ballroom is cold. The heat has turned off. It's dark, too, just as it has been since March. And it's quiet, an especially eerie anomaly for a venue that's hosted live music since the 1940s. We were the first to shut down and will be the last to reopen, says Executive Director Lori Leitz. All employees except Leitz have been furloughed, so she's doing a bit of everything, painting, cleaning, running the gift shop, marketing, tending to the website, applying for grants. She'd like to be planning events, but that's difficult. The reality is we really can't plan a whole lot because we don't know what our capacity will be, and it's more expensive to announce and put an event on sale and then cancel it, or to not do it at all, Leitz says. More than anything, Leitz wants people back, not just her staff, but crowds too. There's really nothing in the world like live music, and so many people are missing that. And the feature continues with stops at various places across the state, concluding with an 8:27 p.m., a picture of the Iowa Hawkeyes playing North Carolina in a basketball game, and finally, at 11:20 p.m. in West Des Moines, Rayleigh Rathkovich is a baby born on that day. And so it concludes with a birth in the evening on the day-long trek through Iowa as people face the pandemic. And that does it for today's reading of the Nonpareil, Daily Nonpareil for this Sunday edition on December 20th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.